Okay, in our last lecture, we saw a data structure that was a restricted version of a linear list. This data structure was called stack. Today, we're going to take a look at another data structure that is also a restricted version of a linear list. This one is called a queue. A queue, like a stack, finds a large number of applications in computing. Now, a queue, as I said, it's a linear list, and we distinguish the two ends of the linear list. One end is called the front of the queue, and the other end of the linear list is called the rear of the queue. The restrictions that are placed on a queue are where you can perform the operations of add and remove. In a queue, you can add only at the rear, and you can remove only from the front. So if you compare this to what happens in a stack you have one end called the top, and the other end of the linear list is called the bottom, and both additions and removals are confined to take place at or from the top. In a queue, one end of the list is called a front, or the front, the other end is called the rear, and additions take place at the rear, removals take place from the front. So here, additions and removals take place from different ends of the list, whereas in a stack, they take place from the same end of the list. Okay. Now let's take a look at an example queue. This will be an example from real life, a queue at a bus stop. As we see the example, note that a queue is a first-in, first-out device. That is, the first item to enter the queue is the first item to leave the queue. Unlike a stack, which we saw last time, was a last-in, first-out device, the last item to enter a stack is the first item to leave a stack. Okay. All right, so here's our typical Florida bus stop. It's a palm tree bus stop. At this point in time, the queue at the bus stop is empty. There are no people waiting for the arrival of the bus. Okay. All right, so at some point in time, we make an addition to the queue, and our first element or member joins the queue. At this time, this person is both at the front as well as at the rear of the queue. All right, then we get another entry to the queue, and the new entry has to take place at the rear, and so it will come to the right of the first person here. And here is our second entry, which is now at the rear of the queue. Okay. So when you have more than two elements in the queue, the front and rear are different elements. A third element, if it were to join the queue, it would join at the rear, so it would go to the right of the current rear, the person in green. And here is our new entry into the queue, and the new entry becomes the rear of the queue. Okay. All right, we make another addition, and that again takes place at the rear. And once again, an addition taking place at the rear. Okay. All right, so when you add elements to the queue, it's implicit that the addition will always take place at the rear of the queue. Okay. All right, finally, when the bus arrives and it's time for people to leave the queue, they're going to leave from the front end of the queue. So the first person to leave is the first person in the queue. So again, the first item that joined the queue is the first one to leave. The front moves, our green gentleman becomes the front element and is the next one to leave. Okay. And then if an addition is made, it's made at the rear. Okay. All right, so a queue is a first-in, first-out device. It's a linear list. Additions take place at the rear. Removals take place from the front. The first item to join the queue is the first item to leave. Okay. All right, so this kind of a queue models at least one class of queues seen in the real world. There are certainly other types of queues we see in the real world that aren't first-in, first-out queues. Queues where people waiting to be served get served in order of some priority. So, for example, if you were to go to the airport to check in for a flight, well, then at the gate, there would be a large collection of people waiting to get into the aircraft. So this collection of people would define a queue, a collection of elements. However, the boarding is not done in the order in which people arrived at the gate. Rather, it's done by priority. Those traveling in first class leave this queue first and get into the plane. Then the frequent flyers get service next, and then you start boarding the plane by rows from the back of the plane. So you have a queue of waiting passengers, people waiting to board the queue, but the queue is not serviced in a first-in, first-out manner, rather by some priority scheme. Okay. All right, later in the course, we'll see queues of this type where service is by priority rather than by the order in which you arrived. But for now, we're going to limit our discussion to first-in, first-out queues. All right, hopefully everybody understands what the data structure is. We can next proceed to provide a specification of the data structure as a Java interface. Now, although Java provides an implementation for stacks, it does not provide an implementation for first-in, first-out queues. Therefore, our interface specification for a queue is going to use names that we have created rather than names for methods that Java might have. Okay. In the case of a stack, our method names were the same as those used for Java's implementation of a stack. But here, we've just decided to stay with names that look like the names for corresponding methods in a linear list. All right, so a queue includes a method to determine whether or not the queue in question is empty. The get front element method returns the element that is at the front of the queue. The get rear element method returns the element that's at the rear of the queue. Put adds an element to the rear, and removes and returns the element at the front. All right, so every implementation of the data structure queue must provide for these five methods. All right, before turning our attention to implementing this interface as a Java class, let's revisit the applications that we studied two lectures ago for a stack, and see which of these applications could just as well be done using a queue and which could not be done by substituting the stack used there by a queue. Okay. All right, so first we'll take a look at applications for which the use of a stack could not or cannot be replaced with that of a queue. And going through the list of applications we saw two lectures ago, if we think back, the parentheses matching really relies on the last-in, first-out discipline. When you see a right parentheses, it matches the most recently seen left parentheses. That's the last one to get on the stack. And so you really can't do the parentheses matching problem by using a queue in place of a stack. Towers of Hanoi, the three towers there operate as a stack, and so you certainly need a stack to simulate them. It wouldn't help you to use three queues in place of the three stacks. Switchbox routing, again, if you think about it, you necessarily need a stack there. Method invocation and return, try, catch, throw implementation, you necessarily need stacks. Okay. All right, you can go home and think about these and convince yourself that if you were to replace the stack used in these applications with a queue, you would not be able to get the application to work right. On the other hand, the rat in a maze application that we saw is one where if you took the stack of active positions and replaced it by a queue of active positions, things would still work. You would still find a path from the source to the exit, or from the entrance to the exit of the maze, provided such a path exists. And in fact, if you were to replace the stack with a queue, what you'd be able to show is that the path that is found is, in fact, the shortest path. Okay. Now, this is not true when you use a stack. When you use a stack, there's no guarantee that the path that is found from entrance to exit is the shortest such path. But when you use a queue, you can, in fact, prove that the path you find is the shortest such path. So if the problem spec were changed from simply find a path to find the shortest path, well, then the stack data structure would not work, and only the queue would work. Okay, let's look at another application, one where we must necessarily use a queue. And actually, this is the rat in a maze application in disguise. rat in a maze application with must find shortest path if such a path exists. Okay. All right, so in the wire routing problem, we're given a printed circuit board, which is the green board that you can see in this picture here. And on the board, what you'll see is you have some active elements or chips, transistors, and the like that are... right, so we have some chips here and here, and then you have maybe transistors and capacitors placed on the board. Okay. All right, so once the elements, chips, etc., have been placed, you then need to run wires. For example, we have a wire running from this pin of that chip to this pin of that chip. You have another wire running from this pin here down to that pin over there. You have a wire running from here to there. Okay. So in the wire routing problem, you start with a printed circuit board, which is this green substrate in the back. Okay. And onto that board has been placed the circuit elements. And then you need to run wires. The requirement is that the wire you run has to follow a shortest path from the start of the wire to the end or end pin of the wire. Okay. So I need to run a shortest path from the start pin to the end pin. And my problem becomes one of finding the shortest routes. Okay. Now, typically, wire routing is done one wire at a time. So you use some algorithm to order all of the wires that need to be done, and then you look at these wires one at a time, and you place them on the board in that order one at a time. Okay. Now, the wire routing problem may be modeled using a two-dimensional array, such as this one here. So you essentially superimpose a grid over that printed circuit board, and then you color some of the squares of the grid. So for example, the blue squares here represent squares that are blocked or unavailable for the wire routing. And a square may be blocked or become unavailable because there is a chip sitting over that square, or because you have already run a wire through that square. Okay. So then you can run only one wire through a square. Okay. All right, so the blue squares represent parts of the printed circuit board that are blocked and not available for routing. The orange squares here, they all represent squares that are available for routing. The green square is the start pin of the wire we wish to route on this round. And the yellow square is the end pin for the wire that we wish to route on this round. Okay. Now, we want to find in this grid, really, the shortest path from the green square to the yellow square. And the way we're going to do this is by starting at the green square and labeling all of its neighbor squares that are one unit wire length away, one. Then we label those squares that are 2 units wire length away from the green square, two. Then label those squares that are 3 units wire length from the green square, three, and so on, until finally the yellow square or the end pin gets labeled. Okay. Now, in this labeling process, we're going to employ a queue. Okay. Now, In order to find the neighbors of a square, so for example, if you start here and you want to find the squares that are one unit y length away, we will work under the restriction that in laying out a wire in one unit square, or in one unit length, you can either move to the square on the right, this one, you can move to the square below you, which is that one. In this case, that's of course illegal because that's a blocked square. You could move one to the left over here, or you could move one up over there, and in this case, that would be an illegal move. But basically, your choices are move one square to the right, one down, one left, one up. In a variation of this routing model, we may be permitted to move diagonally, so even running a wire from this green square to this could be considered one unit, or running from here to there, or there, or there. Okay. Now, in the example we're going to work through, we're only going to allow up, down, left, right movements, no diagonal movements of wires. Okay. All right, so we start at the green square. And we look at our four neighbors. We determine which of the four represent legal moves. So those are basically orange squares. We label them one, and then we'll place the squares labeled one on a queue. Okay. All right, so now our queue contains these two orange squares, okay, this one and that one. And for the next round, what we'll basically do is we'll extract one square from the queue, look at its neighbors, and label them with the next number, in this case, 2. Then we will extract another square, and the squares that get labeled will get tossed into the queue. Then we'll extract another square from the queue, label those squares with the next number, in this case, 2, and toss them in the queue. Okay. And then we're going to kind of continue this process. In each cycle, take one square off the queue, label its, look at its four adjacent squares, label the orange ones with the next number, and put those labeled squares on the queue. And we kind of continue this till we reach the destination or end pin, the yellow one. Okay. All right, so in this example, let's suppose that the first square that we put onto the queue was this. So when we remove from the queue, this fellow will come off. We look at its four neighbors. Okay, that one is orange, that one is orange, that's orange. So these three are orange. And of course, what I didn't say was they must be orange and unlabeled. Okay, so these are orange and unlabeled, so we're going to label those two and put this on the queue, and that on the queue. Then we're going to extract from the queue, so it'll come from the front, so this will come off the queue. The squares labeled 2 won't come off because this square labeled 1 got on the queue before the square labeled 2 got on the queue. So we'll pull this one off, look at its four neighbors, and of its four neighbors, the one above and the one below would get labeled 2. Okay. And they will also get put on the queue. Okay. All right, so now if you were to look at the queue, the two ones have been pulled off, and we just have the squares labeled 2, and all the squares labeled 2 are 2 units from the start pin. Okay. Now, continuing our cycles, we extract a square from the queue. It's going to be one of the twos, whichever one is at the front, okay? And let's suppose it's this one. You look at its four neighbors and look at the unlabeled orange one, that's that one, so that'll get labeled 3 and put on the queue. Yeah, the square labeled 3 is at the rear of the queue, so before it comes off, all of the ones currently there which have a label 2, they're going to come out first, okay? So you always see the twos before the threes and the threes before the fours and so on, because the queue works in a first-in, first-out fashion. Okay. All right, so this fellow would get labeled 3, then maybe we'll extract this fellow from the queue. It's four neighbors, none of them leads us to a new square, so none of those get labeled. This one comes off the queue, and this fellow will get labeled 3. This guy comes off, that gets labeled 3. This guy comes off, that gets labeled 3. And at this time, all of the twos have been taken off the queue, and we're left only with a bunch of threes, namely the squares labeled 3. Again, what you see is that the squares labeled 3 are all of the squares that are 3 units away from the start pin. Okay. And that then means that the squares that are 4 units away from the start pin are the ones that are 1 unit away from the squares labeled 3 and not yet labeled. So when we do the next remove from the queue, a square labeled 3 comes off. Let's suppose it's that one. You look at its four neighbors, and this one gets labeled 4. The others don't get labeled again. Okay, this one is already labeled 2. Okay. Then perhaps this one comes off the queue, so this gets labeled 4, that gets labeled 4, that gets labeled 4. This one comes off the 3 of the queue, that gets labeled 4. That one comes off the queue, and no new neighbors are found to label 4. Okay. So that way you identify all of the squares that are exactly 4 units from the start pin. And once you're done identifying all the squares that are 4 units from the start pin, your queue contains only those squares that have labels 4. All of the 3s have been taken off. Okay. All right, so you continue, you remove a square labeled 4. The next time you do a remove from the queue, perhaps it's that one. This gets labeled, that gets labeled. When you remove this one gets labeled, that one gets labeled 5. When you pull off this one, that gets labeled 5. When you pull off that one, that gets labeled 5. Everybody who gets labeled 5 is put on the queue as they're labeled. And once you're done pulling off all the 4s from the front of the queue only has squares with a label of 5. Okay. All right, continuing this, you pull off the 5s one at a time from the front of the queue. Look at the neighbors, label them 6. When you label something 6, it gets put on the queue. And when you're done removing everybody from the front that had a label of 5, you're also done identifying everybody that's 6 units from the start pin. And in this process, actually, our end pin, the yellow pin, got labeled 6. Okay. So now we don't need to continue labeling. We know that the start pin and end pin are exactly 6 units apart. And so I need to have a wire whose length is 6. All right, having determined that, I can actually get the wire path by following backwards from the yellow pin or end pin. Since the end pin is labeled 6, I know that around it, there has to be at least one pin labeled 5. Okay. If there's more than one, it doesn't matter. I just pick one of the two, and I move to that picked square labeled 5. Okay. Now, around the pin labeled 5, there has to be one labeled 4, because the only way you can label somebody 5 is if you come from someone labeled 4. Okay. Again, if there's more than one square labeled 4, you just pick one of those arbitrarily. Around the 4, there has to be a 3. Around the 3, there has to be a 2. Around the 2, there must be a 1. And around the 1 must be the start pin. Okay. So working your way backwards, you can find the wire path whose length is 6. And this, in fact, is the shortest wire path. Okay. All right, so by employing a queue and starting from the start pin, labeling neighbor squares, pulling off a square from the queue whenever you're done with the previous square, you can label all the squares with their shortest distance from the start pin. You stop this process when you either reach the end pin or your queue becomes empty, in which case you can't find any more squares to reach, and that in turn tells you there is no path from the start pin to the end pin. Assuming you find a path from the start pin to the end pin, you're assured that this is the shortest path. The physical path is obtained by retracing from the end pin to the start pin using labels that were placed on the labeling path. And then finally, you need to go clean up your labels so that you can perform the next wire path determination. And for that, you run this labeling process once again. Starting from the start pin, you go and you clean up those labeled 1 around the start pin, then you go clean up the labels 2 around the start pin, then 3 until you finally reach the end pin. Okay, so an application where one must necessarily use a queue is wire routing. If you look in the book, there are other applications where you need queues. Well, let's turn our attention now to implementing the interface queue. As in the case of a stack, we could start by looking at implementations that derive from existing implementations of a linear list. So for example, we may start from an array linear list. And really what we would need to first do is identify which end of the linear list is going to be the front and which is going to be the rear. So first, let's suppose this end is the front and that end is the rear. Okay. So with this identification, we can see what shape our code is going to take and also what the complexity of the code is going to be. So if you want to code up the isEmpty for a queue, well, we'll just call the isEmpty method for the superclass ArrayLinearList, and that runs in order one time. Okay. To get the front element, we need to get the element at the left end, so we can call the getZero for our superclass. Okay. And that's an order one operation. To get the rear element, that's the same as getSize minus one. So again, you get one line of code, you just invoke getSize minus one. That takes over one time. You want to put an element into the queue. We're going to do this at the right end, so that's add at size. Okay. Adding at the right end is order one time. And you want to remove, you're going to remove from the left end, so that's a remove zero. But when you remove from the left end, okay, if you remove this item, then all of these items need to be shifted one position to the left. So the complexity of the remove operation is order of size. Okay. All right, so this mapping doesn't work too good for the remove operation. It's pretty good for the others. All the others run in order one time. So we might try to switch things around and see if things work differently if we made the left end of the list the rear and the right end the front. Right, this doesn't change the complexity for many of the operations. IsEmpty and get for an array linear list take order one time, no matter which element you're trying to get or when you're checking if it's empty. The put operation, you now have to put at the rear, so that's at the left end, so we're going to be putting out here. Okay, when you're adding an element, that would mean you need to shift all these one to the right. So the add operation for the queue takes order of size time, whereas it took order one before. The remove, we're going to be removing from the right end. Okay. So that only takes one unit of time. You don't have to shift any elements around. Okay. All right, so once again, we don't really end up with a satisfactory solution. This time, the add operation takes order size time. Okay. All right, so if you want to get order one time for each of the queue operations, we need to come up with a custom representation. And we shall look at this in a moment. But first, let's take a look at the linked version. Okay. So this time we're going to derive from one of our linked list classes. The class we're going to use is extended chain. Extended chain is much like chain, except that it keeps track of the last node in a chain, okay, and supports an operation to add out here. So it has an append operation that would take order one time. It also has a get last element, so it can retrieve this one in order one time because it has a pointer to the last element. Okay. All right, so again, we could try identifying the left end of the list as the front, the right as the rear. And then we could do the inverse of that and see which of the two works out better. Okay. All right, the complexity of the isEmpty remains order one. You simply check size. Get front element, you have to get the element at the left end, so that's get zero. Okay. It's an order one operation. To get the rear element, we use the special method of extended chain get last, and that takes order one. You want to add an element, we're going to add it to the right end. That's an append method of get chain, of extended chain, that's order one. And remove is remove from the left end, remove zero, and that's also order one. Okay. All right, so if you derive from extended chain, then all of the linked queue operations take order one time. provided you associate the front with the left end of the list and the rear with the right end of the list. Now, if we did the association the other way around, things don't work out quite as well. Okay. The isEmpty is still order one. Get front element is now becomes get last, that's still order one. Get the rear element is a get zero, that's order one. When you want to add an element, you now want to add to the left end out here. So adding to the left end of a chain is also order one. Okay. When you want to remove, you want to remove from the right end this one. But to remove this, you need to back up this pointer to this node here. And the only way to back up this pointer from this node to this is to start from the first node, march up one node at a time to determine who comes just before the last node. As a result, there is no order one way to do a remove last node operation. And the remove operation for the queue takes order size time. Okay. Right, so if you make the association right, left end is front, right end is rear, everything takes order one time. If you do it the other way around, left end is rear, right end is front, then the remove operation takes order of size time. Okay. So in this case, there's a clear advantage to mapping or associating the left end of the list with the front of the queue and the right end of the list with the rear of the queue. All right, even though that association gives us order one-time operations for all of the queue methods, there's still advantage to be gained by a custom linked class for queue. We would get performance improvement by a constant factor. Okay. All right, finally, let's take a look at developing a custom array class for queues. One which allows us to perform all of the queue operations in order one time. Okay. We're going to make use of a one-dimensional array. We call that array Q. However, in our minds, we are not going to view this Q as having a left end, or this array as being a linear organization of space with a left end and a right end. Rather, we're going to view it as a circular organization of memory. So the positions are index 0 through 5. However, in this view where we say 0 is at the left end of the queue, 5 is at the right end, over here there is no concept of left and right. This is a never-ending array. It begins at no particular point, ends at no particular point. If you were at position 1, you could go to 2, 3, 4, 5, back to 0, 1, 2, 3, so you could kind of go around this circle forever. All right, so this is just something which is conceptual. It's in our minds. We are going to view our one-dimensional array as though it were circular rather than flat. Okay. If you have three elements to place in this queue, these three elements can be placed in any three consecutive spots of the array. So for example, A, B, C could be placed in spots 2, 3, and 4 in this fashion. Okay. Or they could be placed in spots 5, 0, and 1 in this fashion. Okay. So since it's a circle, the spot after 5 is spot 0, the spot after 0 is spot 1. In the flat representation of array, there is no spot after position 5. But in the circular representation or interpretation, there is a spot after every spot of the array. All right, our implementation is going to make use of two variables, front and rear, which will help us locate where the first element of the queue is and where the last element of the queue is. The convention we're going to adopt for the variable front is somewhat counterintuitive. Instead of having front tell us where the first element of the queue is, it's actually going to be positioned one counterclockwise from where the first element really is. Okay. Intuitive positioning or for this variable would be front tells you where the first element is, but we aren't going to do that, and we aren't going to do that because using this definition, front being one counterclockwise from the first element, enables us to check for empty and full queues somewhat easier than if we had gone otherwise. Okay. All right, the variable rear will have its intuitive definition. It actually tells us where the last element of the queue is. Okay. All right, so for this positioning of a three-element queue, A, B, C, front isn't going to be 2, it's going to be 1 counterclockwise from 2, namely 1. Okay. Rear is going to be 4, that's where the last element is. For this one here, front will be 1 counterclockwise from A, okay, so it'll be a 4, and rear will point to the last element, C, so rear would have the value 1. Okay. All right, next we need to see how would we perform the add and remove operations with this representation. Okay. Now, to add an element to a queue, we'd of course want to be sure we have space in the queue in the array. If you don't, you'd want to go into something like array doubling. Let's ignore that for a moment. How do we tell whether we have space or not? Let's look at the concept level. Suppose there is space, how are we going to add an element? Well, if you're going to add an element to a queue, for example, this one, you need to add the element at the rear, which means it has to come over there. And to accomplish the add, we would first move the rear variable 1 clockwise, so from 4 to 5 in this case. Okay. And then we would put the new element into the position pointed to by the variable rear. Okay. All right, so that's really how we would perform the add operation. Okay. We can take a look at the remove operation. Okay. Somewhat similar, to remove an element, naturally, you first need to make sure it's not empty. Okay, if it's empty, you can't remove an element. But assuming it's not empty, the first thing you do is you need to know where is the first element. Well, it's not here. It's 1 clockwise. So I would need to move the front variable 1 clockwise. And once I have moved the front variable 1 clockwise, I can then extract the element from there. And notice that once you have moved it, you have correctly left front. It is now 1 clockwise from the new front, which is B. Okay. Okay. So to add and remove elements, I need to be able to move my variables front and rear one position clockwise. And let's see how we might do this. Okay. To move, say, the rear variable clockwise, we could first increment its value by 1. Okay. When you increment the value of rear by 1, you move it clockwise in almost all cases. For example, if rear was 4, it would become 5. If it was 0, it would become 1. If it was 1, it would become 2, and so on. The only time this doesn't work is if rear was 5, it would now become 6, when it should have become 0. Okay. 6, of course, is the length of the array Q. So if the value becomes equal to the length, you need to kind of wrap it around and down to 0. Okay. Right. So these two lines of code would move the variable rear one position clockwise, and an equivalent code for our purposes would be to simply add 1 to rear modulo the length of the queue. Okay. All right, so the single line at the bottom would accomplish the same that is accomplished by the two lines at the top. Okay. The variable front can be moved in a similar fashion. All right, to complete the picture, we need to know how do you tell when the queue is empty, how do you tell when it's full. Okay, and let's take a look at what happens when you start with a queue that has elements in it, and you empty it out one at a time. Okay. So when the queue becomes empty, what you find is the front catches up with the rear, front equals rear. And we're going to use that as our test for an empty queue. Whenever front equals rear, the queue is empty. And this also tells us that the initial values for front and rear at the time you create the empty queue would be 0. well, the initial value would be that front equals rear, and then you do need to have some specific value. It doesn't matter whether you initialize front and rear to 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, so long as you give them some legal value in the range of allowable indexes for your array. To be definite, we will use the value 0 for front and rear. Okay. All right, let's take a look now at what happens when a queue gets full. Okay. So you add an element, you add another element, you add another element, and now the queue is full. And again, what we see is that front equals rear. Okay. So the condition to check for a queue being empty is the same as the condition to check that a queue has become full, which really means that we cannot distinguish between when a queue is empty and when it is full. Okay. If you were to do this and then you came to the remove operation, the remove would say, well, is front equal to rear? If so, I'm empty. Okay. So the remove would fail to remove an element thinking that the queue is empty. Right, so we really can't allow for the full and empty conditions to be the same. Okay. And we need some remedy. Okay. Right, there are different remedies one can think of. One that the text uses is you simply don't let the queue become full, okay, which means that if you have an array that's capable of holding six elements, as in our example, when somebody asks you to put in the sixth element, you simply say, well, I can't do it, so I'm going to do array doubling a little bit earlier than I need to. Okay. So an array of length 6 really can hold only 5 elements. Once you try to put in a sixth, you double it, make it a size 12, and now you can go up to 11 elements. When somebody tries to put in the 12th, you double it to 24, and then you can go up to 23, say. Okay. Or another possibility is to make use of a Boolean variable, last operation is put, which actually tells you whether or not the last operation that was done was an add to the queue. Okay. So following each add operation, you set this variable to true, and following each remove operation, you set it to false. Okay. In that case, to check if a queue is empty, well, the queue can be empty only if two things are true. One is front equals rear, and the last operation wasn't a put. Okay, if the last operation was a put, well, then that last item that went in would ensure that your queue is not empty. Okay. A queue is full only if front equals rear, and the last operation was a put. If the last operation was not a put, then the queue couldn't possibly be full because you took one item out most recently. Okay. Now, this would solve the ambiguity problem with front equals rear. However, it requires you to do one extra piece of work every time you do an add and every time you do a remove. You got to set this variable. So it increases the complexity of removes and add operations in a queue. All right, yet another possibility is to define a variable called size, like we did for a linear list. And following each put, you increment size by 1. Following each remove, you decrement size by 1. So now you can use the variable size to tell whether your queue is empty or not. If the size is 0, the queue is empty. If it's not 0, it's not empty. A queue is full only when the size equals the length of the array. Okay. All right, so this also solves the problem that we had, that front becomes equal to rear, both when the queue is empty as well as when the queue is full. Like the remedy that made use of the Boolean variable last operation is put, this one also requires additional work. You need to increment size every time you do a put. You need to decrement size every time you do a remove. Okay. Whereas the first solution that was given, namely simply don't allow the queue to get full, doesn't require any additional work. and so its performance is slightly better. Now, while you might normally think that, well, if you're doing one extra increment or decrement, it's not going to have much impact on performance, in the case of the queue operations, without this extra work, you're probably doing only like three operations in an add or three operations in a remove, and now we're going to add one more, making it a fourth one. So that's a significant increase in terms of percentage increase in number of operations. And since when you use queues, you tend to perform maybe thousands of adds and removes from the queue, so even a small increase in the runtime of a queue could have a significant impact on the overall runtime of your code. So if you think back to wire routing, if you're working on a, let's say a 1,000 by 1,000 grid and you're trying to lay out 50 wires, you're going to run Lee's wire router that we talked about 50 times, and each time you run it, you have a potential of maybe putting 1 million things on the queue and taking 1 million things off the queue. So it could amount to a noticeable difference in performance whether your queue has four operations in it for each add and remove or whether it has three operations in it for each add and remove. Okay, so we've seen that by taking a circular view of our one-dimensional array, we can in fact come up with an array representation for a queue in which all of the operations take order one time. Okay, we're going to stop here for today.